Money FM 89.3, best of the breakfast huddle. The weekly wrap on Money FM 89.3.
Money FM 89.3. Good morning. It's the Breakfast Huddle. Ellie Danka, Bharti Jagdish and Ryan Huang with you. Big news earlier this week when the government released the white paper on Singapore's women's development proposals for 25 action plans in five key areas.
And among those five areas, actually, these are the five areas: equal opportunities in the workplace, recognition and support for caregivers, protection against violence and harm, and other support measures for women and mindset shifts as well.
Let's get into it with Dr. Rashima Raja, who is lecturer, Department of Management and Organization at NUS Business School. Good morning.
Morning. How are you guys?
Very good. And lots to talk about. 25 action plans to be implemented over 10 years. I'm very excited. What was your initial reaction?
Definitely, my reaction was a positive one. These 25 steps were definitely going in the right direction because these five areas of improvement really addressed many of the challenges that women in Singapore face. Some of the areas that I particularly liked were having more policies to protect women from harm. I think they were really good. I think there was kind of this fear that, you know, women become litigious once these policies are set in place. But I think the reality is that many women are afraid to speak up when it comes to violence at home or even at the workplace when they face harassment or some sort of microaggressions. So having these policies set in stone, I think those will really help to protect women from violence and harm. I just wanted to really also applaud the government for highlighting mindset shift as an area for improvement. I think we need to realize that women should be perceived as equal to men. And we see this, you know, trying to be implemented at the workplace. But one comment I would have is also to try to recognize that men can also be equal to women when it comes to other areas of life, for instance, at the home.
Right,
so,
right.
For instance, you know, caregiving duties can be shared more equally. And when we have kind of men more involved in the conversation, I think that's one step towards achieving gender equality.
You know, I'm so glad you brought that up, because in order to level the playing field at the workplace, you've got to level the playing field at home, right?
Right.
Things like flexible work arrangements, parental leave, if offered more readily to and taken more liberally by women than by men, work against women, in fact, when it comes to career progression. So while we say, okay, men and women perhaps should work this out on their own, shouldn't the government and workplaces perhaps be doing more to send out the right signals in terms of policy and action? Perhaps increasing government-paid paternity leave, something that a lot of men have been asking for. Addressing mindsets and actions on the ground when it comes to employers allowing men the freedom to take advantage of flexibilities. What do you think?
Exactly. I completely agree with this. And many parents whom I personally talked to told me, you know, 2 weeks of paternity leave is just not enough. But at the same time, I think the government has a dilemma, because the figures as of 2019 showed that only 55% of eligible employees actually take up paternity leave. So increasing the length wouldn't improve the situation per se, but really encouraging people to take up the leave that is available to them. And, you know, one way you can do this is by making sure that you have the correct performance appraisal systems in place, making sure that people feel safe to take advantage of these leave policies and don't feel like this is going to be a career penalty.
Doctor, this might be a bit confusing, or at least maybe I'm the only one confused here. I studied law, and I've always found the Women's Charter outdated. Now we've got these new anti-workplace discrimination laws. Fantastic. What takes precedence? And should we perhaps have a situation where we properly update the Women's Charter instead of... It's like two separate things happening at the same time. You get what I mean?
Yeah. You know, so why have new anti-workplace discrimination laws? You know, why is there a need to set this into stone, right? Well, I think it has to start somewhere.
Okay.
So, in my opinion, so I come from an organizational psychologist background, and if you leave it to the free market, so to speak, right, when you have no discrimination laws in place, there can be biases that occur at the workplace. So let me just give you an example. So in talent acquisition, for instance, in recruitment, we noticed that some characteristics displayed by one gender can be viewed as desirable, but when we have the same characteristics from another gender, it's viewed as undesirable.
Yes, yes.
So if you kind of leave it to the free market and don't have these explicit laws, you know, some of these biases can actually occur. And we're only human. So I'm not, you know, putting the blame on any recruiter or any company. You know, we are only human. And we do have these biases. We tend to select and recruit people who are like us, you know, like attract like. We have to be this in organizational psychology, right? And if we have decision makers who are primarily of one culture or one gender, this then tends to perpetuate, right? Because if you keep recruiting people who are like you, there are some companies that try to overcome this, you know, not through the legal route, but, you know, using things like artificial intelligence, automated CV screening, where they don't look at the candidates and then make the decisions so that they can kind of overcome their own biases. So that's one way, but I think having laws that are set in stone could be also another way for us to just be more aware of the biases that we may have and use these policies to kind of guide us in our decision making.
But since Elliot brought up the Women's Charter, let's talk about that for a moment. All of these things that we're seeing being unveiled now apply to everyone, not just women, although they protect women because women tend to face some of these situations more than men do. The Women's Charter, though, a little more specific, and a lot of men have come out to say things like, oh, you know, there are some of the laws in there, some of the clauses in there are outdated. Some women's organizations themselves have said that maybe we should change it to the Family Charter. So there's a lot going on in that regard as well. How does that fit into the equation today, considering that we have some of these laws that are in the books that apply to everyone equally?
This is an excellent question, right? So as I mentioned earlier, we need to not only regard women as being equal to men, but also men being equal to women. Yeah. And I think for the longest time, when we talk about women's development, we have really targeted our conversations with women. And my opinion is that men should be included in the conversation. Many a times, men are not included in the conversation, you know, because they're not motivated to, because it doesn't involve them. They are not, you know, outrightly sexist, or they're not harming women in any way. So why should they kind of be part of the solution, right? But I think if we kind of include men as part of the solution and actively involve them, and like your suggestion, that's really great, right? It's, instead of having Women's Charter, change it to the Family Charter. I think steps like this would really help with the gender stereotypes and really try to get men aware that this is something that we should implement for everyone, not just women.
I want to jump ahead to one of the support measures that's been talked about a lot on social media, with a focus on elective egg freezing to be allowed from next year, women aged 21 to 35 years. Yeah. My wife and I are out of that bracket, but as global citizens, we've long been lobbying for this. Some people would say, is it bold for Singapore to do so? I would like to ask, this is about time, right? It's quite late, right? What took us so long?
Well, but the thing is, even when the eggs are frozen, the revised laws state that only married couples can use them for procreation, right?
Yes.
And you know, if this was meant to target Singapore's low birth rate, personally, I don't think that would help with the low birth rate a lot. And just because when married couples do want children, they actually do find ways to have children, such as through IVF and other kinds of medical routes, right? So if they were not able to have children because they were married later in life, parents actually, or people who want to be parents, actually do find ways to have children. So restricting this egg freezing to married couples, even if it's elective, it doesn't solve the root of the problem of why people in Singapore hesitate to have children, right? There are higher costs of living because you're part of the sandwich generation, you take care of the elderly and also our children, and things like that. That being said, nonetheless, I think the signal this sends is a positive one. I think it is, as you mentioned, you know, a step in the positive direction when you have regulations that are progressing kind of together with society.
Yeah, I think it's simplistic to assume that one little change is going to bring about big changes in a larger arena. So, moving forward, what more do you think is needed in terms of greater scrutiny when it comes to what has just been unveiled, and other things that need to be considered as we move forward and as more reviews of these guidelines are done?
Thank you for your question. I think moving forward, for the next white paper, for instance, we can afford to be more specific and provide more concrete guidance on how some of these steps can actually be carried out. So, for instance, when I think it was number 4, encouraging greater utilization of parental leave, right? You can encourage them verbally, but as I mentioned earlier, only 55% of eligible employees take up paternity leave. If the employees still believe that it is not safe or a clever career move to take up parental leave, then they're not going to take it up, right? So as I mentioned earlier, organizations need to make sure that there are corresponding mechanisms in place for this encouragement of greater utilization. So they need to have fair appraisal systems that account for people being away for long periods of time, that this is a valid reason to be away, and they need to be evaluated as such.
And valid for both men and women. Also, I think they use the word fairly and properly, but what is fair and proper is also open to interpretation, right?
Exactly. And I think moving forward, if we can have more concrete guidance on this, it doesn't have to necessarily come in laws, as Ellen mentioned, but ways on how to circumvent the root problem. Because people are not taking up these parental leave, not because they want to spend less time with their children, but because there are stereotypes at home, at work, and also other expectations, like, you know, men are expected to take very, very little time off once a child is born, and the same is not expected of a woman, for instance.
Doc, just a final one, and it's a bit tricky. I'm trying to phrase it the best way that I can, if you'll excuse me. Laws aside, do you think there is a resistance? Obviously, there is a resistance, but do you think the resistance is due to an inability to understand the difference between being a feminist versus being pro-woman? So I look at it as, oh, I got to be pro-woman. Why must I be pro-woman? No, it's two different things. Being a feminist is standing for the right thing.
Yep. You took the words right out of my mouth, and I really appreciate that you as a man actually bring this up, because like I mentioned, I think we need to have men in this conversation. As I mentioned earlier, like, men feel like they don't have to be part of the conversation. They don't have to be part of the table when we're discussing this. But I think it's important to recognize that they can be part of the solution, and men and women can work to these solutions together. If I could just take a quick minute to give an example, right? So when we talk about the gender pay gap, for instance, one big reason for this is because men tend to negotiate for more in salary negotiations than women. And, you know, the advice given to women is then go ask for more, then go negotiate for more. But research has shown that women actually receive backlash for negotiating for a higher salary because they are seen as, you know, aggressive and then not easy to work with. But if you actually look at the same, at the very same behavior for men, they're seen as, oh, he knows what he wants, he's a go-getter. And so just understanding that there are different expectations and understanding these biases between among men and women. And I think if we have men to be part of the solution and understand that the circumstances are different for women, that would really help. And it's not about, you know, taking care of another gender or you know, one gender is weaker and we need to protect them. I think it's understanding that they can be part of the solution by looking at the root cause, which is these biases and, you know, implicit expectations, which are applicable to everybody.
You know what the sad thing is? It's all about awareness and ignorance at the same time, because I have met men who claim to be pro-feminist or pro-women, but they make all sorts of sexist remarks as well.
Oh, no.
So those mindset shifts are very important, and I'm glad you said that the education will help. Thank you very much, Dr. Rashima. Dr. Rashima Raja, lecturer at the Department of Management and Organization from the NUS Business School.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download our audio app. That's AWEDIO. Available on Google Play or the App Store.